good friend, Mr. Chairman, and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen. A poor salesman always starts out by apologizing. After finishing the preparation of this paper, I realized that I was faced with two nightmares. The first was, because I had misunderstood, I think, I actually prepared a paper and not a speech. As a result, for the first time in, I guess, over 40 years of platform work, I am reading rather than orating. For this, I apologize. Secondly, when I finished, I realized I would probably step on the toes of everybody interested and involved and in attendance at this meeting. For this, I do not apologize, but I do ask your indulgence. The topic, as you see, assigned to us is who is in charge? Who is in charge of the more than 2,000 institutions of higher learning in the United States? My answer is everybody and nobody. Certainly not the trustees. The unique American-Canadian system of trustee control exists today as a legal fiction more than as a fact. It is probable that trustee control, as originally conceived in this country, will not be revived in our lifetime. If this appraisal shocks anyone, I can only plead that I am not expressing approbation or opposition, but to use the idiom of our students, I am trying to tell it like it is. Whether this modern-day phenomenon is for good or for evil is too involved a subject for this short paper. Suffice this half hour to at least understand the facts. The most distinguished and misunderstood characteristic of American college and university trusteeship is that, with a few important denominational exceptions, absolute legal control over every function of the institution is placed in the hands of lay boards. Lacking the normal checks and balances of the American political and business system, the power is absolute. This authority exists whether the school be public or private, state or local, denominational or independent. It all began in the 17th century with the founding of the earliest small colonial colleges, primarily for divinity training, and continues today even with our collegiate giants. In most other countries, control lies with the state, or as with Oxford and Cambridge, with faculty. Not so with us. Briefly, what is this absolute control? It is the full power to establish policy and to manage not only finances, property, budget, public relations, and the appointment of the president, but also over faculty, curriculum, all educational matters, and student life. To quote the 1642 charter of Harvard College, America's first institution of higher learning, the board was given, quote, full power and authority to make and establish all such orders, statutes, and constitutions as they shall see necessary for the instituting, guiding, and furthering of the said college and the several members thereof. And in finishing said, in piety, morality, and learning, unquote. And in case someone suggests that modern conditions might require a more realistic alignment of this power, the Supreme Court of the United States in 1819, in the famous Dartmouth College case, ruled that a charter granted without reservation is a contract between the state and the corporation and may not be changed without the consent of the trustees. The absolute power of the typical college board of trustees is not only a legal right and authority, it is also a moral obligation and responsibility. Yet, it is no secret within the academic community that the trustees have in fact abdicated the exercise of a substantial portion of this authority. In the moderate language of Laird Bell, former chairman of the Board of Trustees of the University of Chicago, the board has the power to control the institution, but is tolerant in letting the educators, for the most part, run it. A more extreme approach was taken by former Chicago Sun-Times editor Milburn Pete Akers, an old friend, and I quote, "One of the greatest wastes of human resources I know is boards of trustees. They have one purpose, ratify that which has been done for the past 6 months and give the administration a blank check for what they want to do for the next 6 months." Perhaps it's more factual to say that the typical board today has retained to itself policy control and sometimes management over physical planning, investment, fundraising, and the appointment of the president, but has delegated to administration and the faculty both policy and management control over educational and student affairs, as well as the detailed control of the budget. This is true whether the board has done so deliberately and in writing, or whether it has occurred through tolerant default. At the outset, I suggested that everybody and nobody is in charge. Specifically from a 10-year study of the problem, I believe that the policies and management of most colleges and universities are in fact scattered throughout all possible groups and interests in one degree or another of coordination. In general, I would rank the in-charge power groups as follows, in order of greatest influence on the average institution. First, the administration and the president. Second, the faculty. Third, the trustees. Fourth, the students. Fifth, government and the state institution, or general donors in the private institution. Sixth, donors of gifts and grants for research or other specific projects. And lastly, alumni. Parents who have a large stake, and the public upon whom education has the greatest long-range impact, are virtually voiceless. With increasing demand for shared authority by faculty and students, answered by frequent executive acquiescence, these two power groups may rise in this command echelon. To better understand this phenomenon, it might be constructive to take a look at the average American trustee. In a book which will not be published until June, entitled The Trusteeship of Colleges and Universities, Vice President Morton A. Rao of Antioch College reports the following characteristics of our over 25,000 trustees from a large and scientific sample. 86% approximately are male. 75% are 50 years of age or older, and 88% in private institutions, while only 5% are under 40. 1.3% are Negro. 75% live in the same community or state. 75% are Protestant, 82% excluding denominational schools. 83% have one or more degrees. 58% are Republicans, 33% Democrats, but 61% describe themselves as moderates. Their political leanings are no gauge of their attitudes on educational questions. Most common occupations are manufacturing, money management, and the law. Least common occupations are organized labor and the creative arts. There is no close relationship between corporate and collegiate control, contrary to common impression. Only 20% of American trustees and only 14% or beg your pardon, 20% are directors and 14% executives of corporations traded on recognized stock exchanges. There is little college board interoperability. 85% are on one board only, and 84% were never on another board. Median annual income is from $30,000 to $50,000. 16% enjoy over $100,000. The trustee is active on over four other community service boards. His median term is from 4 to 8 years. These are just random suggestions, which I hope to tie in somewhat to a few suggestions to make later. Perhaps even more significant are a few Board of Trustee characteristics reported by the Department of Higher Education of Indiana University after an exhaustive 1967 study of almost all American boards. 57% of all boards have only from 3 to 15 members. Faculty and students appoint almost no members. 10% of board membership are faculty, but seldom appointed by them and seldom from the same school. Less than 1% of board membership are students, primarily non-voting, but 13% of the standing committees of boards are students. Only 50% of the boards meet monthly or often. 70% of all board meetings last from 2 to 4 hours. In 72% of the cases, the college president prepares the board agenda. Only 12% of the boards have administrative offices or personnel outside of the president's office. And much of this is nothing but an administrative secretary. Almost none have an independent research staff. Rao, in his forthcoming book, adds a few pertinent statistics. The average trustee spends approximately 85 hours a year on college affairs, including travel time. And approximately 20 of these hours are spent in fundraising. Only 53% attend all board meetings, and 80% attend three-quarters of them. Omitting the public junior colleges, only 38% of trustees attend all board meetings. Based upon this data and other research our company has done, a few conclusions seem valid. First, the limited time spent on collegiate affairs by the average trustee, in fact, forces an abdication of his exercise of full control. Small boards, infrequent and short meetings, spotty attendance, and less than a total of 2 full weeks a year devoted to work, make it physically impossible to determine policy and manage the intricate affairs of even a small school, to say nothing of our academic reliance. Because the grocery store must stay open, control passes by design or by default to those who will exercise it. Second, it is questionable whether the average trustee is qualified to control any but the broadest aspects of today's highly involved collegiate problem. Recruited largely from manufacturing, money management, and law, as I've indicated, the trustee must, or may be more comfortable, in controlling finance, physical property, investment, public relations, and fundraising than the mysteries of the academic world. Conversely, many boards have abdicated control in an area where they could be most effective, student morals and discipline. Third, perhaps most trustees do not have the inclination to exercise full control. I may be overstating the case. It may be many, but I do know many. They are limited by time. Too many are elected as fundraisers or as window dressers. Many find themselves in a strange environment, particularly the 17% without collegiate degree, and most are intimidated by superior faculty appointments with academics. In a teaching and research atmosphere where over 50% of modern knowledge was not taught when these over 50 trustees were in school. And then, what trustee is inclined to dictate student conduct when he's not sure how successful he's been with his own children? Four, even with college boards seriously attempting to fulfill their responsibility, trustees are unable to act intelligently on policy questions because of a communications gap. They lack sufficiently complete information objectively presented. Such lack arises in fact when the administration presents little or no data on the agenda question, or when the administration presents just enough to support the result it wishes, or when such a volume is supplied, and I have been the victim of this system, when the busy trustee lacks time to absorb it, and therefore, in effect, is deprived of it. The problem is compounded by the fact that few boards have their own research staffs and are dependent almost entirely on the president for information. Five, and here again, I repeat, I may be treading on a lot of toes. I would also like to repeat, because of the shortness of our time, many of these statements sound unanimously broad. I am, of course, always talking about what our data and research indicates is the generality. There are multitudes of exceptions. Five, humans being human, there is a continual erosion of trustee effectiveness through the power-grabbing tendencies of the president, the faculty, and the student body. Whether we like it or not, ladies and gentlemen, we should face the facts of life. A president strengthens his leadership by taking or manipulating power, and he can do it by dictating the board agenda, which most of them do, as well as by spoon-feeding the data and opinions supplied to the board. The faculty, zealous to increase the independence, security, and integrity of its own informal academic union, and conscious of its weight of numerical as well as professional strength, manipulates more and more decision-making power, not only from the trustees, but also from the president. Impingement upon presidential authority by the so-called democratic power groups within the faculty is as major a problem, in my opinion, as their usurpation of trustee control. And then we have the students. Traditional mechanisms through student boards, newspaper control, give them a powerful influence. But with current ferments of dissatisfaction, fanned by racist problems and outside subversive influences, substantial minorities are demanding participation in administrative and board powers. Through spineless administration decision, failing to segregate the issues from the tactics, and motivated often by sheer fear, students often get more than is healthy for them or for the institution. Perhaps the faculty and student upsurge in power control is enhanced by the minimal representation these groups have on the average board of trustees, as well as by lack of communication between them and the board. Having briefly analyzed the phenomenon of trustee power erosion, it would be natural to indicate solutions. Time today does not permit such an exploration, but I would like to suggest a few avenues of constructive consideration. Of course, there are many who feel that the status quo is quite adequate. It can be argued that this developing American system has produced as flourishing, as varied, and as successful a pattern of higher education as exists anywhere on earth. And certainly no one can challenge the integrity, devotion, sacrifice, and ability which generally characterizes the top level of stewardship given by our college trustees. For those who are concerned, however, with corrections or improvements, serious thought should be given to a clear-cut modern definition of the role of the trustee in whatever institution. Many frictions would be eliminated by a clear understanding of the expected function of each of these cooperating power groups. Either the American trustee must make the effort to exercise his control function, or clearly delegate unwanted responsibilities to those who will. In making its delegation, however, the board might well keep in mind several fundamental principles. First, to avoid the arbitrary exercise of total authority, which is their right if they wish, it should not be necessary to abdicate basic responsibility. Sound judgment is still the most imperative quality of a trustee. Secondly, delegation to the president, and through him to the faculty, of the administration of curriculum, research, and general academic matters should not relieve the board of the desire and obligation to determine broad academic policy. The board must decide quality and direction. It must judge the academic balance sheet as carefully as it analyzes the financial. Thirdly, careful re-examination should be given to one of our most explosive problems, the impact of total freedom of expression, and I say total freedom of expression, by the faculty. There can be no question of the faculty's right to speak out on all matters wherever it wishes. No question, academic or public. The question is whether the board should take exception where such expression tends to harm the public image of the college or to impair the soundness of value being imparted to the student body. In no other American institution is an employee completely free from the consequences of adversely affecting his institution by public expression. This question is a matter of board policy. It should also be a matter of re-evaluating judgments by the faculty. Four, whether a power is retained or delegated, one of the trustees' most effective weapons is seeing that his institution is in seeing that his institution is well run, is to probe with penetrating questions every recommendation made by the president and every item on his agenda. This technique can avoid the trustees trying to run the entire institution, but permit him to see that it is well run. In that way, the board establishes itself as the body before which the administration must justify its own stewardship. The board should see to it that it has professional advice on what questions to ask. Even with a clear definition and delegation, an interesting legal question arises. Is the American trustee to be held legally liable for abdicating or delegating his responsibilities and power? Are we facing a rash of lawsuits against trustees by parents, students, donors, foundation, alumni, or just plain taxpayers? It is happening today with business corporation directors to the point where many are resigning and or declining to serve. It could happen in the academic world. Finally, whatever the solution to the power question, the entire problem poses to me a broader moral challenge. Is an institution of higher learning merely an academic community? Sifting and winnowing the conglomerate body of advanced learning, preserving the professional integrity of the faculty and the administration? Or is it a total community, guiding not only the learning, but also the morals, manners, and characters of the students who must go forth to build a better world? The answer to these questions may indicate the proper accord to be given the real interest of parents, donors, taxpayers, students, and those who prefer the integrity of the fundamental principles upon which our free enterprise system was founded. Ladies and gentlemen, we may not know who is in charge today, but we do know who has the most at stake. The countless coming generations who will suffer from our petty power struggles, or who will live in life because of our broader vision. And I thank you very much.